period for permanent marriage, mm-hmm. which is of course three menses,
mm-hmm. basically 3 months.
I will tell you that mm-hmm. Sometimes it has to be 3 months and sometimes 3 menses, okay? Mm-hmm. Depending on whether a woman has reached menopause or not.
I see.
Depending on whether a woman has regular menstrual blood or discharge or not, mm-hmm. okay? If a woman does not get her period, even though she is young, she is at an age where she's supposed to have the monthly period.
Yes.
Okay, but because of some reasons, okay, medical reasons, she does not have her regular period, and sometimes maybe she has, and sometimes she does not have. So, in the event that she doesn't have her regular period, then she has to observe iddah for 3 months.
I see.
And in the case of temporary marriage, she has to wait for two months if she does not get her period,
uh-huh.
monthly period. Otherwise,
if she gets it, if 45 she gets days. It,
it's going to be 45 days, and if she gets it, it's going to be 3 menses. As soon as the third menstrual period
mm-hmm.
starts, then she is considered to be out of the waiting period. And then all the things which were haram for her become halal. Like, for example, getting married to another woman, talking to another man, talking to other men for, let's say, for marriage, for, mm-hmm. yeah, for let's say, lawful relationship. Yes, these are the things which are halal. And then we have a third one.
Yes, the third time.
The third waiting period is the waiting period which is for the death of observed on the death of the husband, you see, which is called idda of death or idda of wafat, okay? Mm-hmm. And of course the...
How long is it?
Yeah, the waiting period for the death of the husband is 4 months and 10 days. Four mm-hmm. months and 10 days. So if a woman...
Doesn't it depend on whether the woman is experiencing menopause or not?
No, it has nothing to do. It has nothing to do with menstruation. It has nothing to do with
menopause.
being in menopause or having attained menopause.
Mm-hmm.
And of course, whether a woman is aged or old or young, she still, out of respect for her husband, must observe the waiting period.
Mm-hmm.
Of course, waiting period does not mean that she cannot interact with other people, she cannot go out shopping, she cannot, go to her relative's house. Of course, all these activities are allowed. Unlike some people who think that a woman who is in her waiting period must not interact with other people, must not go out shopping, and she must not do anything. She must wait in her house and do nothing. That's not the correct assumption. It's not correct to say that a woman mm-hmm. cannot do this. Of course, a woman in her idda of death, and the idda of death, is not supposed to wear new and fashionable clothes.
Mm-hmm.
She cannot wear makeup, and she cannot talk to any man for marriage, okay? These are the two things which are haram. Otherwise...
So they can't even perform nikah.
Yeah, of course.
Right?
That's
no, I'm not talking about marriage.
Yeah.
Then.
The performing nikah is not allowed, okay? But when the 4 months and 10 days are over, then of course she can wear new dress, new mm-hmm. clothes, and of course there's a difference between wearing new clothes and wearing neat clothes, you know?
Mm-hmm.
It's permissible to wear neat and tidy clothes, you
yes.
know, but it's not permissible to wear fashionable and new clothes to express joy and happiness, and also it's all because of respect for the husband who has died, okay?
I see.
And there's also a kind of iddah which is observed by a Muslim woman whose husband has left Islam, whose husband has abandoned Islam.
Mm-hmm.
Like, for example, there is a Muslim woman whose husband was Muslim, But all of a sudden, she the husband actually apostatizes. He let's say converts to Christianity or Judaism, or he converts to another religion, leaving Islam. Okay.
Mm-hmm.
So when the husband becomes kafir, non-Muslim or unbeliever, the woman is supposed to observe iddah of 4 months and 10 days. During this month, this time, 4 months and 10 days, if the husband returns, gets back, and regrets his decision to change his religion and to go out of Islam,
right,
and he comes back to Islam, regretting and expressing actually remorse, in that case, of course, they can get back to each other, and there's no need for any nikah. But if during this time the husband does not come back to Islam and does not regret his decision, of course, the marriage is null and void, and of course, the woman can marry another woman without there being any nikah, because that is without there being any divorce, because leaving Islam, apostasy, is itself breaks the marriage. Okay,
yes.
There's no need for any divorce.
And in that case, when the husband, in fact, leaves Islam,
sure.
Well, is the waiting period again necessary for the woman?
Why not? That's what I'm telling you.
Yes.
Because the waiting period is 4 months and 10 days. I
yes.
said. This.
But the waiting period goes away as soon as the husband gets back to Islam again.
Of course, yeah. When the husband comes back and says, "Okay, I have done a great mistake.
Yeah,
yes. I don't want to. Yeah, I'm still a Muslim. I've done a great mistake. Astaghfirullah," and he's repentant. And of course, then the husband and woman can live together during the waiting period without a need for any for renewing the nikah.
I see.
Yes.
The Office of Ayatollah Sistani is currently providing the following services. 1. Board of Istifta, replying to religious questions. 2. Helping the poor, needy, homeless, and those who have suffered losses by earthquakes and floods. 3. Sending books for people who want to understand and learn Islam. 4. Hajj delegation. 5. Sending preachers. Board of Istifta is a link between Ayatollah Sistani and people. It provides them with answers to questions pertaining to religious, ideological, social, and educational matters in accordance with the verdicts and rulings of Ayatollah Sistani. For more information, visit the website of Ayatollah Sistani at www.sistani.org. You can also ask your questions through the following email, english@sistani.org.
Imagine a situation, Sheikh Tawheed, that we have a temporary marriage between a man and his wife, and they decide to change this temporary marriage into a permanent one, okay?
Yeah.
And the time of the temporary marriage is left, that time that they
yeah.
promise each other
yes.
and decide on. A part of it is left, so it's yet to expire. And can they change the marriage into a permanent marriage, first of all? And second, is there any iddah that has to be observed by the woman in this case with the same husband?
Yeah, of course, this is also one of the frequently asked questions. A lot of couples, you see, when they start living together, first they contract temporary marriage.
Mm-hmm.
Temporary marriage.
Yes.
And then they, after a few months or a few days, they renew. They actually change the temporary marriage into permanent marriage.
Right.
There's no objection as far as this practice is concerned. But of course, the temporary marriage cannot be changed into permanent marriage without the husband foregoing or exempting the wife of the remaining time. So there are two options that the husband and the woman should opt for. One is the husband should forego the remaining time forsake the remaining time, or he should exempt his wife of the remaining time. This is one option. The other option is that the woman should wait until the period fixed for the temporary marriage expires, comes to an end, and then they can contract permanent marriage.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah? They can conclude permanent marriage, and there is no other way. As long as the time of the marriage contract,
mm-hmm.
temporary marriage contract,
yes.
remains,
mm-hmm.
And as long as the temporary marriage is in effect, the husband cannot actually conclude permanent marriage.
Okay.
The permanent will be null. Permanent marriage will be null and void.
Thank you very much, Sheikh Javid. That was the program Islamic Laws on RIB English Radio. Thank you very much for listening to us. Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
Hussein Barakat was sentenced in 2018, along with 53 other individuals, to life in prison in a mass trial of 138 Bahraini citizens due to their opposition to the regime's decades-old discrimination and tyranny. He was also stripped of his citizenship, which was later restored by royal decree. Reportedly, there were 15 prisoners in Barakat's cell, which had only 10 beds, hence some of the inmates had to sleep on the floor. Bahraini human rights activist Mariam Khawaja, whose own father is imprisoned in jail, said Barakat told his wife during his last phone call that he could not breathe and was going to die. The fact is, since the outbreak of the coronavirus inside Bahrain prisons, preventative measures inside prisons have not been implemented, and the authorities continue the policy of deliberate medical neglect.
They are known for their unhealthy environments and lack of basic necessities, especially at this dire time and at this crucial time of the pandemic outbreak. And those prisoners, as we know, normal patients, the people who are outside the prison, suffer a lot. So what about those who are in prison, who already are suffering?
Meanwhile, dissolved Bahraini opposition group Al-Wafaq has been calling for the release of prisoners of conscience since the start of the pandemic. According to Americans for Democracy and Human Rights in Bahrain, a second outbreak at Jao began on the 22nd of May and has infected an estimated 60% of the 255 political prisoners housed at Building 12 of the prison. An earlier outbreak in March saw at least 140 inmates infected with the virus.
Bird estimates that the total number of COVID cases in both Zhao and the Dry Dock Detention Center has far exceeded 200 cases since March.
This, of course, amounts to a deliberate killing, to a political assassination, as if the government of Bahrain, if not murdering those prisoners during torture, during executions, it's now dealing with the outbreak of the coronavirus pandemic as an opportunity to revenge against those political prisoners, merely because those political prisoners, those peaceful protesters, political activists, human rights defenders, clerics.
Speaking from inside the Dry Dock Detention Center, inmate Ali Al-Haji said, "Most prisoners are mistreated, physically and mentally. It's always the same thing, torture and a lack of proper medical care." Particular concern has been raised about the aging leaders of the 2011 pro-democracy uprising, including Hassan Mulshema, who is in his 80s and suffers serious health conditions, placing him at high risk from coronavirus.
The only crime of those political prisoners is that they have called for an elected government, for a constitutional monarchy, for a new constitution which guarantees their rights, their freedoms, which tolerates all citizens equally.
In the words of Hussein Abdullah, executive director of ADHRB, following this tragic death, the Biden administration and the UK government must make clear to their Bahraini allies that holding political opponents as hostages will no longer be tolerated.
The Bahraini government deals with the political prisoners, more than 3,000 political prisoners, as hostages. It neglects their rights merely because those people have once took to the streets and called for their basic freedoms, their basic rights. So it's the same practice, as the practice of the Zionist occupiers against the Palestinians. They have a lot of commonalities between those two parties. So they deal with those people as they are hostages. They neglect their rights.
Hussein Barakat's son, Ali Barakat, is also serving a 22-year sentence in jail after being convicted on political charges in a separate case when he was just 16. Despite an earlier outbreak of COVID-19 at the prison in March and April 2021, the prison administration had still failed to distribute face masks or hand sanitizer to protect prisoners. Overcrowding in Bahrain's prisons is a long-standing concern which makes social distancing impossible. In early April, inmates at Bahrain's Zhao prison protested against a lack of medical treatment, fearing for their lives after the death of another inmate. Prison authorities instead threw stun grenades, beating inmates with batons to force them back inside their overcrowded cells.
The inmates have been protesting about conditions of detention, in particular the lack of access to medical treatment. The sit-in began on 5th April after a political prisoner, Aba Malala, died after reportedly being denied timely access to essential health care. The lack of health care in the overcrowded Bahraini prisons has been an issue for years, but has become a chronic problem during the COVID-19 pandemic.
Hussein Barakat's death could have been avoided had the Bahraini regime heeded calls to set free political prisoners so as to prevent the spread of the virus.
Victim Hussein Barakat hasn't been the first victim who passed inside the Bahraini prisoners. We have a lot of cases. We have Martyr Karim Fakhrawi, who died in prison and because of torture. We have the case of Sayyid Qadim al-Sahlawi. Also, we have the case of Martyr Muhammad Sahwan, who had like mostly 80 sharpness in his head because of the riot police. There are a lot of cases of prisoners who passed away inside those notorious prisons merely because of torture, of medical neglection.
With overcrowded cells, unsanitary conditions, and a lack of preventative measures, this disastrous outbreak seems to continue and claim more lives of those whose only crime was calling for freedom and democracy. What you heard was an IRIB English radio program. Please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
Good morning, good afternoon, good evening, wherever you are and wherever you are listening to us.
The keys of life.
I thought Jawadi talks about the various keys of life and has brought about this book to be a companion for the very famous Mafatil Jinan, where one is a tool or the keys for paradise, and this book, of course, are the keys of life.
The Keys of Life, a program designed to tell you that what Islam gives you will help get you home with joy and faithfulness. So, well, listen to
The Keys of Life.
The world is a very, very big house, many people living in many rooms. We must open all the doors up, we must unlock them all today. Throw all the keys away.
أعوذ بالله من الشيطان الرجيم بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم الحمد لله رب العالمين والصلاة والسلام على سيدنا محمد وآله الطاهرين. My name is Sheikh Zaid Al-Salami. A few years ago I started the course of wanting to commentate on a very important book that I believe is something that would be useful for everyone who reads it, and that is the book Mafatih Al-Hayat, written by Ayatollah Al-Uzma Al-Sheikh Jawadi Amuli. We're now up to chapter 3 of part 2, and this chapter, after talking about how to deal with fellow Muslims, is talking about how to deal with non-Muslims. And of course, this is a very, very vast topic. It's never going to be something that we would be able to cover in one or two or a few sessions. But Ayatollah Jawadi Amuli points to some very, very important issues that we need to remember as Muslims. One of the blessings that we do have in our Islamic heritage is when we look at the verses of the Holy Quran and we look at the authentic riwayat from Ahlul Bayt alayhim as-salam, we can gather one fundamental principle, and that is that we need to look at all fellow human beings in a good way, with compassion, with respect, with honor. Now, does this also mean that we fall into that kind of understanding that, well, be a pacifist and, you know, object jihad and stay away from fighting the enemies of God and all these other kind of issues that is also a part of our faith as Muslims? other faiths, other religions don't have this problem because you don't see the concept of military warfare or the art of combating against the enemy constituted within the foundations of their jurisprudence or of their ideology. You know, it's all something that has been introduced. You know, you don't see in the other religions that concept of what we call as jihad, or what we know as the, you know, al-jihad al-azghar, which is defending the grounds or the land or the territory of al-Muslimin. Anyway, this is a very, very vast topic. I won't be able to cover it all, but I'm mentioning this because, you know, unfortunately some people have fall into the wrong misconception of becoming an apologetic Muslim and saying, well, no, I'm against jihad, or I'm this, or I'm that. And that's also very, very dangerous, you know. Another side is, because there is that level of jahl, real jahl, ignorance, and sometimes it's intentional, and sometimes it comes from malice, evilness, from Islamophobes who, you know, have a perverted understanding of what Islam is because of them reading baseless information from random places or from people who did have hidden agendas and evil motives, or from people who are deviants, people who have a perverted understanding of Islam, like all of these, unfortunately, all of these terrorist groups, terrorist Muslim groups that are out there these days, al-Taliban and Qaeda and beyond.
Ayatollah Javadi Amoli, the author of the book Mafatih al-Hayat, The Keys of Life. This book, Mafatih, ought to be in two volumes. One volume, the present volume, Mafatihul Janan, is on the level of the lofty rewards for praying, fasting, etc. But the book lacks its second volume, which ought to be on subjects like the lofty rewards for planting a tree. Imam has mentioned both of these subjects. The very Imam, who has stressed out the reward for praying, has also highlighted the reward for planting a tree. There are generous amounts of reward for protecting the environment. When growing wheat, take some in your hand and say these prayers. These are what the very Imam has mentioned. We lack this second volume in Islamic world.
Does Islam as a religion endorse any kind of radicalism or extremism or disassociating or unfriending those who are different to you in their opinion or even in their faith? Absolutely not. Imam Ali alayhi salam, in his advice to Malik al-Ashtar, he said that a human being is either akhul laka fid-deen, your fellow brethren in religion, أو نظير لك في الخلق, or they are similar to you in creation. So you need to make sure that you take care of both of them, whether they are a fellow Muslim or whether they are not. And the same way as Islam condemns the non-Muslims who are attacking Muslim territory, Islam also condemns fellow Muslims or those who appear to be Muslims from attacking other Muslims as well. You know, look at the story of Imam Ali alayhi salam and the battles that he had during his khilafah. Who killed Imam Hussein salamullahi alayhi? And, you know, compare that to the battles that Rasulullah sallallahu alayhi wa alihi wasallam had, which were all defensive battles. Important point here is, for those who really are genuine, who those who really want to, you know, have a correct insight into Islam, listen to what it is that authentic, genuine, mainstream Muslim ulama, Muslim scholars have to say about this topic. And Sheikh Jawadi Amuli, the first thing that he says when he's talking about non-Muslims is, there are two ways of looking at non-Muslims. One is those who are monotheists, and the other way is the dealing with monotheists, muwahideen, and then dealing with mushrikeen or polytheists. Alhamdulillahi rabbil alameen, wa salatu wa salamu ala Sayyidina Muhammad wa alihi tahirin.
Driving past, walking fast, to the field of dreams, hear the children's screams.
That was The Keys of Life by Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran, IRIB English Radio.
Every corner represents a different image in my mind. A momentary emotion, space spent in time. Memories fade like a dusty window pane. And you can't see your past no more. The only thing that remains is that feeling of warmth in your heart that will always be there, be there.
The Pentagon said recently the U.S. State Department has approved the potential sale of F-16 fighter jets as well as Sidewinder and Harpoon missiles to the Philippines in three separate deals with a combined value of more than $2.5 billion. We're prepared through an article written by Richard Javad Haydarian titled U.S.-Philippine Arms Deal Aims at South China Sea. The article has been published by the Asia Times. With likely long-term strategic implications, the U.S. State Department cleared a multi-billion dollar arms package to the Philippines on 24th of June, which includes up to 12 state-of-the-art multi-role fighter jets. According to the proposed deal, the Pentagon is set to provide up to 10 F-16C Block 7072 aircraft and two F-16D Block 7072 aircraft manufactured by Lockheed Martin, as well as long-term training and assistance with maintenance of the aircraft. The Defense Security Cooperation Agency, DSCA, has also cleared the sale of 24 Raytheon Technologies AIM-9X Block 2 Sidewinder air-to-air missiles worth $42.4 million and 12 Boeing AGM-84L1 Harpoon Block 2 anti-ship missiles worth $120 million. Amid rising tensions in the South China Sea, the Philippine Defense Secretary, Delphine Lorenzana, emphasized how his country needs this multi-role fighters, especially that the situation in this part of the world is deteriorating. If approved, the $2.43 billion deal would be the largest of its kind in the history of the two allies, marking a dramatic elevation in bilateral defense cooperation. The timing of the announcement was also crucial, coming only weeks after the Philippines decided to again suspend the abrogation of the Visiting Forces Agreement, the VFA, until the end of the year. Should the two so-called allies finalize the deal in the coming months, it will set the tone for bilateral relations under the next Filipino president, who will assume power by June of 2022. For years, various Filipino leaders, especially current President Rodrigo Duterte, have fretted about America's long history of dumping Vietnam-era weaponry on its century-old ally. Earlier this year, President Duterte threatened to abrogate the VFA unless the U.S. provided $16 billion in defense aid to the Philippines, highlighting large-scale advanced weaponry that Washington has handed to other countries such as Pakistan, Egypt, and the Israeli regime over the past decade. Various American administrations, as well as the Pentagon, shunned the sale of state-of-the-art military hardware, raising concerns over the Philippines' ability to effectively maintain modern weaponry. Chronic corruption and limited defense spending also torpedoed earlier efforts by various Filipino presidents to ramp up their country's defense acquisitions. Added to this has been half a century of rebellions across the Philippines' impoverished peripheries, which deprived the country's naval and air forces of much-needed resources for external defense in favor of the insurgency-focused army. In the 1990s, former Filipino President Fidel Ramos, a U.S. West Point-trained general, sought to modernize the country's defense capabilities, especially after the withdrawal of U.S. bases and the subsequent Chinese siege of Manila-claimed Mischief Reef in the South China Sea. Under Fidel Ramos' armed forces of the Philippines modernization program, the Southeast Asian country sought to acquire, among other things, advanced fighter jets, including 12 FA-18CD Hornets. However, the ensuing Asian financial crisis undercut the first serious attempt at revamping the country's armed forces. As a result, the country went from having one of the most advanced militaries in the region in the mid-20th century to lacking even a single fourth-generation fighter in the first decade of the 21st century. However, under former President Benigno Aquino, the Philippines launched its second version of the Armed Forces of the Philippines Modernization Program, the Revised Armed Forces of the Philippines Modernization Act, allocating billions of dollars to augmenting the country's air force and naval capabilities. During his first 3 years in office, the former president, Aquino, allocated $648.4 million for new acquisitions. Between 2013 and 2017, defense spending increased by 17%, with the former president allocating $1.73 billion for new procurements. Although his successor, President Rodrigo Duterte, had adopted a diametrically opposed foreign policy of warmer ties with China, his top generals have continued to build on former President Aquino-era reforms. Philippine Defense Secretary Delphine Lorenzana, a former defense attaché in Washington, took up the cudgels of the succeeding phases of the 15-year Armed Forces of the Philippines Modernization Program. Under the Horizon 2 phase, the Philippines allocated about $5.6 billion for augmenting the country's capabilities against the so-called external threats, including the acquisition of advanced frigates, strategic missile systems, and fighter jets. The Horizon 3 phase, which would fall under the next Filipino president, is set to cover the acquisition of, among other things, the country's first submarines. Thanks to former President Aquino's efforts, the Philippines has managed to acquire modern frigates as well as modern fighters. Korea Aerospace Industries FA-50PH, which were deployed during the recent standoff with China in the Whitsun Reef. facing increasing tensions in the South China Sea, the Philippines is intent on acquiring multi-role fighter jets amid an arms race in the region, with China now rolling out its own fifth-generation stealth fighters. Defense Secretary Lorenzana said recently during his speech at Sandy Datu Air Defense Exercise in Base Air Base, which is close to the disputed Scarborough Shoal. He said, "We're pushing for the acquisition as it is critical capability for the defense of our country's territorial airspace from any form of threat and enforcement of Philippine Air Defense Identification Zone." Lorenzana, who talked to the Philippines' existing yet limited inventory of modern warplanes, said, "With multi-role fighter aircraft, we can explore the facets of air power." He added, "Likewise, it is imperative to fast-track the establishment of a standardized tactical data link so that all our assets may be able to talk to one another." The proposed F-16 deal with the United States falls under the Philippine $1.8 billion multi-role fighter acquisition project, or Horizon 2 project. After culling multiple bids from leading defense contractors, the country is now deciding between Sweden's much cheaper Saab JAS-39C Gripen or the U.S. much more advanced Block 7072 version of the F-16 fighter jet, which is commonly used by top North Atlantic Treaty Organization NATO allies. Most defense experts agree that the F-16 fighter package is the runaway winner, but the Philippine defense chief has fretted that it is expensive for the Philippine Air Force. Defense Secretary Lorenzana told the Philippine Daily Inquirer recently, "The U.S. wants us to buy the F-16 jet. It's very expensive to the Philippine Air Force, and we're evaluating others." The final details of the proposed U.S. fighter jet deal, which also requires congressional approval, are still up for negotiations. Top Philippine defense officials may seek a better deal with their American counterparts in order to purportedly set the tone for more robust bilateral relations under President Duterte's successor beginning in 2022.
وقضى ربك ألا تعبدوا إلا إياه وبالوالدين إحسانا.
Your Lord has decreed that you shall not worship anyone except Him, and He has enjoined kindness to parents. Humanity. Sayyid Abdullah Al-Musawi.
A'udhu billahi minash shaitanir rajim. Bismillahir rahmanir rahim. Brothers and sisters, dear listeners, assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh, and welcome to IRIB English Radio, and you are listening to the program For Humanity. We are still looking at Islam and how it established and built the pillars and the foundation of human rights way before any other civilization and before any other religion in that regard as well. Among the things that Islam established when it came to the notion of a human rights was the right to worship your Lord or your deity, or to have your religious beliefs or no beliefs intact and preserved. We see that if we look at the history of Islam and Muslims, from day one, the Prophet sallallahu alaihi wa ala, when he began his preaching the religion of Islam, it was an invitation. An invitation for a better life, for a better way of living, for getting rid of all this paganism, all this ignorance, all these acts that were done in the name of greed, in the name of, I don't know, trying to gain wealth and so on and so forth. So it was just a call. So the Prophet sallallahu alayhi wa alayhi would circulate around the Kaaba. He would recite verses from the Quran. He would advise people. And that was about it. You want to take it, accept it? Sure. You don't want to accept it? Also, that's also your choice. So there was no compulsion. There was no force in the preaching of the Prophet sallallahu alayhi wa alayhi. Even when the Prophet sallallahu alayhi wa alayhi migrated to Medina, established his city, established his civilization, he went on to even create one of the greatest armies, yet he never used any of this that he had to force people into doing things that he wants them to do, or force them to become Muslims or change their beliefs and stuff like that. In fact, he left them as they are. Even when he managed to conquer the city of Mecca and go back, he also did not force people who were in Mecca to be Muslims. No, they still remained on their faith. Those who changed out of their own will, and those who haven't, then the Prophet sallallahu alaihi wa did not do anything in this regard. So you can see that this is the first thing that he began with. There's no compulsion. Second, that the Prophet sallallahu alaihi wa ala and Islam in general, they not only did not force people to accept, but they gave them the freedom to believe and have their beliefs and have their synagogues and their churches and their places of worship and even their books intact. None of that was destroyed or demolished in Islam. So Islam did not say, well, okay, now it's a Muslim country, now the city is under the Islamic law, therefore we need to demolish all the churches and all the mosques. Islam did not do that. In fact, the Islam emphasized on the fact that these places need to be protected, need to be taken care of under the Islamic government. And you can see even that the Jews remained in Medina while the Prophet sallallahu alaihi wasallam was there. They were worshipping their Lord based on what they think is correct, and that was never taken from them. And so this is just how Islam came to establish this notion of the right to worship what you worship, and to, you know, accept what you want. And not only that, but we will give you the support that's required, and we'll also give you the protection that's required for you to practice what you are practicing. Now let us take a break and then we come back, inshallah.
This is Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran.
Contact us at EnglishRadio@irib.ir.
Welcome back to IRIB English Radio, and you are listening to the program for humanity. Just before the break, we were saying that Islam established the notion of everyone has a right to believe in whatever they want to believe in. And under the Islamic government, they preserved churches and goals, and they gave their people the right to practice whatever they want to practice. If you look at the United Nations Human Charter in Article 18, it says that everyone has a right or the freedom to think and to accept whatever religion they want to believe in without being forced to change it, and without, you know, being stopped from preaching it or teaching it. So this is the Human Right Charter, which is, in fact, it goes, you know, very well with the Islamic notion that we just spoke about. So Islam and the United Nations Charter seem to agree on one thing, or at least they have taken that from Islam to begin with, because Islam preceded this charter in over 1,000 years. And then we say, well, this is an Article 18 in the United Nations Human Rights Charter. How much of this is actually applied in the Western countries that you know, acclaim to be champions of human rights? You can see that, without giving too many examples, of course, without going in details, of course, you can see that in now what is being created in the Western media is what we call Islamophobia. So where you have Islamophobes who go around and they're trying to create this mass hysteria about Islam, to the extent that even governments now, they're taking measures to prevent some certain Islamic beliefs being practiced. For example, you have many times in different countries of the West, obviously without naming names, you have closure of mosques. So they come to mosques and they close them because what? They brand them as, you know, a hub for terrorists and what have you, right? So under different pretexts, some mosques get closed, some centers get shut down, some Islamic schools get shut down. They prevent them buying, and they prevent them from having permits to build their own mosques. Obviously, we're not generalizing, so we have to be clear of that. But it's happening in different countries, and sometimes in one country, in one place, they might give a permit, they might let a Muslim do his thing. In another state, they might prevent him from that. Or sometimes from the same, in the same state, you have this, you know, give and take relationship with them. But the idea was that you still have this persecution against, even sometimes even against Muslims themselves, personalities, preachers, or the imams or sheikhs, whatever you want to call them. Sometimes they are the target. In one of the countries that I was in, one of the very active sheikhs that we have, he was extremely active. He was he had all the youth around him. He was doing such a marvelous job in trying to guide the youth and bring them to the right path. And a lot of people who are atheists and Christians became Muslims. The government saw that as a threat. And this person got deported from this country because they said, well, he's too active for us. So we, if we compare Article 18 of the United Nations Human Charter, which they believe in, compared to what actually takes place, we see there's a very thick line of hypocrisy going on. Now, we'll leave it up to here, and inshallah, we'll continue in episodes to come. Until then, stay with us. Wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh. Allahumma salli ala Muhammadin. Allahumma salli ala Muhammadin. Ya Rabbi salli ala Muhammadin wa ali. Ya Rabbi salli ala Muhammadin wa ali.
This is the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran's broadcasting. The Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran is broadcast daily from 1520 to 1620 UTC on the following frequencies. Shortwave, 41 meters, 7410 kilohertz for Indian subcontinent. And FM 91.5 megahertz for Tehran. You can also listen to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran on Heartbird, Eutelsat 3B, and IranSat or BAT 5, and via internet. Our internet address is parstoday.com/en. And now you can listen to IRIB English Radio via your mobile phone. Please refer to our website for the details.
This is IRIB English Radio. Coming up is the news.